today's programme, Club 18 to 30, we'll have reaction to that surprise move by the Health Minister to assess if younger people should be prioritised for vaccines. Will the gap between COVID jabs be extended to speed up the first dose rollout? We'll talk to the HSE's Colm Henry. Mandatory hotel quarantine under scrutiny. Are more exemptions on the way? With the black economy booming, ISMI's Neil MacDonald on why small businesses are struggling to find staff to reopen after the long lockdown. And mergers and acquisitions. Why is the Irish banking market shrinking? All that and more coming up after the news with Susan Jackson. Thanks, Susan. Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. My panel today, James Brown, Minister of State with responsibility for law reform, Roisin Shortall, co-leader of the Social Democrats, and David Cullinan, Sinn Féin spokesperson on health. You can text us on 51551, you can email saturday@rte.ie or tweet to @SaturdayRTE. But first today, I'm joined by Colm Henry, Chief Clinical Officer of the HSC, who's joining us from our Cork studio to update us on the vaccination rollout after what was by any measure a roller coaster week. Good afternoon, Colm. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Good afternoon.
Let's start with the good news. That extra 545,000 doses from the Pfizer vaccine that we're now told will begin to arrive from Monday week. Are we confident now, Colm, that we will get that in the 50,000 batches week on week for that period?
Certainly increasingly confident, Katie. It is good news, especially coming on the news we received earlier over the AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson vaccines. So, yes, we're increasingly confident. If you look at the supply lines of Pfizer, they certainly have been less subject to disruption than the supply lines and the deliveries from AstraZeneca. So we're hopeful that we'll be seeing those deliveries coming in bunches of 50,000 vaccines per week from the end of April onwards, and we'll be able then to direct them towards those groups to whom this vaccine has been given, and that is under the latest allocation sequence to all those under 60 years of age, and of course as those two to the over 70s who are well into their vaccination schedule now.
And I think people are so bamboozled by the numbers now, Colm, will that effectively bring us back on track in terms of our rollout targets?
Hopefully, yes. Certainly, we had to do some furious remodelling this week with the news we had about AstraZeneca. So we're certainly hopeful that with this extra delivery of Pfizer, as I said, we'll be able to direct it towards those most needing of groups first. That's older people, second dose vaccine, and those less than 60 as we go down. And then and that will bring us back on track. But it's a little early to say, but certainly it puts us in a much better position than we were a couple of weeks ago.
And we know the HSC facility for booking COVID-19 vaccination appointments open to 67-year-olds today. What is your advice now to people out there who are in this 60 to 70 age cohort who may have genuine reservations about taking the AstraZeneca vaccine?
Well, I understand people having reservations because when they read the stories of this unusual clotting disease, it can cause distress and anxiety. And of course, there's no medication, there's no vaccination, it doesn't have a side effect. But the evidence is overwhelmingly in favour for these people in this age group that the vaccine affords great protection. And that's not just the evidence that's coming through from the trials, it's the real world evidence. And we're seeing evidence come through, particularly from the UK, where there's been widespread use of this vaccine, of a huge drop in hospitalisations and serious illness in all age groups, including older age groups, with the AstraZeneca vaccine. And in addition, we're seeing evidence that supports the idea that there might be reduced transmission of the virus, reduced asymptomatic carriage of the virus among these groups. So it is. I would advise anybody who's listening, who's offered this vaccine, take the vaccine. You have much, much more to fear from the virus and the serious illness it can cause than from what is a very rare side effect, so far predominantly appearing in younger age groups associated with the AstraZeneca vaccine.
If you do, though, still have those reservations, you refuse to accept the AstraZeneca, will you go to the back of the queue, as in the words of the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar?
Well, our aim is to vaccinate as many people as we can, and we want to reach as many people as we can in this decade to give them individual protection and also in turn hopefully to reduce transmission as the evidence builds up that that's in fact what vaccines can do. So I would encourage anyone, we're not in a position to offer an alternative vaccine to this age group at the moment. There's huge benefits, substantial benefits in terms of reducing serious illness for people in this age group, and I would encourage them to take the chance book for the vaccine, get the vaccine, get covered, get protected.
But just to be clear for those people, if they don't take it now, when they're offered it, when they at this point, that it may be some time before it swings around to them again and they're offered another vaccine. It,
to be clear to your question, Katie, we're not in a position to offer an alternative vaccine at this stage, no.
What about healthcare workers? They're due to receive their second dose of AstraZeneca shortly. Would you be concerned now that you may come across some hesitancy there as well, particularly with the younger workers in that cohort?
Of course, and I can understand this because, again, if you look at this age cohort, younger people especially, they may think to themselves, well, they have much less to fear from the virus. They're much less likely to become seriously ill, to be admitted to hospital, to require intensive care and so on. And they'll look at the side effect, which is very rare, by the way. This rare clotting event occurs in between 4 and 10 cases per million in based on the data we have so far. So I can understand people's anxiety, particularly if they're quite young, in their 20s or 30s, about getting a second dose. What I would say are two things. First of all, NIAC has advised that the second dose be protracted out to 16 weeks to allow us time, to allow them time, along with other regulatory agencies throughout Europe, to look at any evidence on the relative safety of a second dose. And based on the data we have so far, again, predominantly from the UK, this very rare side effect is predominantly associated with the first dose. Based on about 20 yeah. million doses given in the UK, an assessment of 100 serious side effects, 99 were associated with the first dose and one was associated with the over 1 million doses, second doses. So now this evidence will build up in the coming weeks.
And yeah, because they're just getting to a lot of their second doses
correct.
Over there now, aren't they?
Correct. And I would emphasise that the evidence needs to build up, hence NIAC's advice to protract out that second dose to 16 weeks to give us more time to build up more evidence so that we can give the right advice, and safety has to be the forefront of this programme.
Okay.
The vaccination programme is based on confidence and safety, and we want people to take the vaccine up and we want them to feel secure in taking the vaccine that is right for them.
Okay, so we're keeping a watching brief basically on
yes.
that. The other issue that's in the front of the papers today, the Irish Independent reporting that the health that there's going to be a move to extend the gap between receiving a first and second dose of Moderna and Pfizer from to up to 8 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks. What is your clinical assessment of that?
Well, to be clear, people are looking at the possibility of this, but no decision has been made. To reassure anybody listening today that the gap that is there remains there at the moment for Pfizer vaccine, 28 days. It is, of course, authorised or licensed to go up to 42 days. But beyond that, and we know that the UK, particularly again to reference that country, they opted for a strategy to cover as much of the population as they could with dose ones, at the expense perhaps of not covering everybody with dose twos within the vaccination schedule. And that's a strategy that they chose to pursue. I think it's too early for us to say we're going to pursue that strategy. We have to look at the medical evidence. There is growing real-world evidence of substantial protection after the first dose of all vaccines in terms of hospitalisation and serious illness. As to how protracted and sustained that protection is, we can't be sure. And of course, people want to achieve that goal of being fully vaccinated because of all the benefits that may bring in time. So I would say we're looking at the evidence now. No decision has been made, and to be clear about that, Katie, to anybody who's listening.
I appreciate that, and it's important to say that, of course, but it's being reported that the health advice recommending an extension of the gap is going to go to Cabinet on Tuesday.
That's not our current position, no. To be clear about this, the Pfizer vaccine is currently a 28-day gap. It is licensed or authorised up to 42 days, but no medical advice has yet been crafted to give to government to extend this beyond
what we're doing now.
We currently apply.
Which is 28 days.
Yes.
Okay, the next one, again, front of the paper this morning, this time at the Irish Times, that Health Minister Stephen Donnelly has asked his department officials to assess the possibility of younger age groups being vaccinated earlier than others. I saw Paul Reid just there in the last hour confirming that the HSE hasn't been involved in discussions in relation to this. What's your sense of this, Parliament?
Well, I've heard arguments and I listen to a lot of experts over the vaccination programme. We've all learned to listen to them because they're the people who know best about this, and not just in this country, but beyond and internationally. And of course, an argument has been made that if you want to reduce transmission, if that's your primary goal, that you should hit that section of the population who perhaps are more at risk for transmitting the virus onwards. Hence the argument for focusing on younger people. But to be clear about this, if you look at the experience of our country and other countries, and anybody who's worked in the hospital system or nursing homes the past week would have seen the devastation caused by COVID in terms of death, illness, serious illness, admission to ITU, and long COVID syndrome. And these consequences of this virus predominantly are sharply associated with age. There is no doubt about that. So if the primary focus of our vaccination programme is to reduce harm, then we need to focus, as we have done, on residential care settings, as we have done on those over 70, as we are now doing in those with age 60, 69, as we are now doing in those with serious underlying conditions that puts them at particular risk, and then in decreasing our order of age. Because what we've learned the past year is that the risk for somebody in their 60s or indeed in their 50s of hospitalisation, death or ITU admission is substantially greater than somebody in their 20s.
Yes, but I suppose that the point is that once you get the over 50s done, do you then look at infection rates generally and how to attack those on that basis?
Well, as I say, there is an argument, and that argument will have to be underpinned by solid evidence. And in fairness, it is increasing that there's evidence that the vaccine does reduce transmission. If I could reference briefly, Katie, one study in the UK showing that household contacts of vaccinated healthcare workers had much lower disease levels than household contacts of unvaccinated healthcare workers. So there's building evidence that the vaccines do reduce transmission. But the overwhelming evidence in terms of where a vaccination programme should focus is on harm reduction based on on individual risk to older people, to those with underlying conditions, and of course to our healthcare system, which has borne the brunt of three surges now since February and March of last year.
So in your view, what I'm sensing from you, do you think we should stick with the plan as we have it?
Well, I think it's a valid question to ask, and I know it's not just been asked by us alone, but I think we have to look at the evidence. We have to look at where we best focus this precious resource at this stage. I'm saying at this point in time, the experts I listen to inform me, and that includes people in NIAC, that we're best to focus on harm reduction through an incremental approach to age, working downwards.
And
if the evidence comes to light that when we reach a certain point in age, that we can then switch to hitting transmission, because the evidence supporting the vaccine stopping transmission builds up as it is, well then of course we can the allocation strategy can be changed.
Okay, and ultimately I presume this would be come from NIAC, the advice on a change of this.
Ultimately NIAC will advise government and the government will advise us, and we as has happened to date is we will respond to the advice that comes through from NIAC through government, and however difficult that my advice may be to put into operation.
Can I ask you then about the vaccine registration system that we now have in place? There's a report in the Irish Independent today that system allows people to claim a false age when they register. There's nothing there to stop you from making yourself older, I suppose, if you wanted to go jump up in the queue. Would you be worried that some people might be doing this?
Well, certainly it's disturbing to think that anybody would try to falsify their details to get onto a vaccination
program. We've seen a fair bit of queue jumping so far.
Yes, I understand. But to be clear about this, when people then turn up for vaccination, they're then going to have to show evidence to support whatever evidence they logged on.
And is that the case, yeah, that they won't get a vaccine unless they have ID showing that they are who they are and the age they are?
Absolutely. So however people want to behave in terms of misrepresenting their age, and I expect it's not that common, but if it is happening, the same people will have to give the same supportive evidence when they turn up for vaccination. And we see a huge uptake now. I think approaching 70,000 people have registered in this portal today. It's showing a big uptake despite what concerns people may have about the vaccine. It shows people want to get vaccinated to understand the benefits, and that's just going down incrementally through the 69, 68 and 67 year old people. So we're seeing a big uptake and big enthusiasm for this vaccine.
And can I ask you then about the question of maternity hospitals? And, you know, there was a lot of concern and upset around the fact that partners were not being allowed in to attend scans, particularly the 20-week scan and labour and, you know, people having to labour alone. What is, if you could just clarify, the current situation in hospitals now?
Yes, to be clear about this, there is some degree of confusion over this, Katie, and it gives me the chance, asking me the question gives me the chance to clarify that. Our advice nationally has been clear, and that is that we recognise that a huge distress that absence of visiting for particular groups, including nursing homes and, of course, women who are pregnant. So what we have said in our advice is that people should have a partner with them for the 20-week anomaly scan that people would be familiar with, and they should have a partner with them when they're in labour. and that parents should be able to visit neonatal intensive care units should the newborn child be unwell. Of course, the caveat there is, or two things. First of all, that people understand this, that the strict adherence to infection prevention and control measures are observed wherever they visit. And secondly, that in times of great threat to hospitals, such as we saw in January, where in some hospitals we had multiple outbreaks and where there were closure of services, there may be a temporary suspension of visiting rights based on local risk assessment. But the national advice is very clear to all our maternity units, is that a partner should be with the woman at the anomaly scan and when they go into labour in the hospital.
Okay, I'm sure that'll come as a great comfort to a lot of people who are going through pregnancy at the moment. Can I ask you, just as we're talking there, Colm, we've had a number of questions all on the same theme. So if you'll bear with me, I'll just put a couple of them to you by email and by text. Katie, please ask Colm Henry about the fear of the South African strain, only 10% efficacy with AstraZeneca vaccine for the over 60s. I have another texter in here. Hi, Katie, just listening to all the talk. No, sorry, this is the one. Not so much worried about the clotting, more about the efficacy, especially against the South African variant. This is from Irene Kerwin, who's 67 years old. Is that something that is concerning yourselves in the HSE, that this cohort, who are still very vulnerable if they were to get sick, has a low efficacy when it comes to this new variant?
Well, the variants, particularly the P1 and the 351 variants, are of concern to us because of the association they have with weakening the antibody response to this famous spike protein. So, of course, we're fearful, hence the measures that have been brought in to government to try and slow down the entry of these variants into our state and to slow down the spread once they enter our state. And the numbers are relatively small so far, and they're vigorously and doggedly followed up by our public health departments. But there is some evidence of reduced in the particular mutation these variants carry, of reduced of increased resistance to the vaccine. One study showed a resistance, particular inability to reduce mild and moderate disease, but there still remains substantial evidence that the more serious illness is prevented by the vaccine, notwithstanding the fact that there's greater resistance to the vaccine among these strains. Our approach has to be, of course, number one, is to try and slow down the spread of these variants, both in entering the country and spreading within the country. And secondly, to proceed through vaccinating as much of our population, particularly vulnerable groups, particularly those in those age groups, as quickly as possible, so as to reduce the chance of that mutation spreading within these groups and to afford them the greatest possible protection.
And just before I let you go, Colm, this idea that we may need booster shots, I saw the CEO of Pfizer coming out this week saying that in as little as maybe 6 to 9 months, there may be a requirement for a booster shot to deal with these variants.
So what we know to date, Katie, is that the antibody response, that's the immune response when people get naturally infected, sustains for about 6 months. There are other elements of the immune response which perhaps last longer. And that tells us when people get naturally infected, they've got some kind of protection for 6 months and perhaps longer. And our expectation is, it's too early for us to say with the vaccine how long the response will be. It may well be that we'll be entering a scenario like the flu vaccines, where people need a booster shot every year or every 2 years. It simply is too early for us to say. I saw that statement made by the CEO of Pfizer. Our own experts here at NIAC and Karina Butler will be liaising with their colleagues in Europe to determine in time whether or not people require a booster dose, and if so, what the schedule should be. And it's simply too early to say.
Okay. Colm Henry, Chief Clinical Officer of the HSC, many thanks for joining us this morning. We leave it there.
Saturday with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. And just a reminder, my panel today is James Brown, Minister of State with responsibility for law reform, Roisin Shortall, co-leader of the Social Democrats, and David Cullinan, Sinn Féin spokesperson on health, is joining us from the Waterford studio. Can I go to you on a number of those issues that we covered with Colm Henry there? First of all, James Brown, Minister, that issue about the report in the Irish Independent today suggesting that there was advice in relation to extending the gap between the vaccines going to Cabinet on Tuesday. Colm Henry didn't seem to say that that wasn't the case.
In terms of extending the vaccines, it's certainly something that has been asked to be reviewed by the minister in terms of the length of time in administering the second vaccine, and can it be done? And the minister is of the view that there's a decision will be made on that, and he's waiting for options to be brought forward. So it's something that's under consideration. But
But the report that it's going to go before Cabinet on Tuesday is not accurate?
Well, the report that it's going to go before Tuesday, I think the aim was to have it before Cabinet on Tuesday, but I don't believe the report is ready yet, so it's something I think that's open. But if it's simply not going to be ready for Tuesday, the important thing is that any information or any science behind it is 100% correct, and if further consideration needs to be given, it's better to get this right rather than to move too quickly on it. But I think if it can be done, I think it would be a very positive move.
Well, do you think it would be a positive move, Roisin Shortall?
Well, it would if the medical advice supports it. And, I mean, a lot of these issues depend on what the medical advice is and how you balance the risk involved. I think, you know, stories been spun to the media aren't particularly helpful to people. It would be much better if the government did its kind of research on it, did its homework, and then made announcements, because it just adds to the confusion around these things. And similarly with that story in, on the front of the Irish Times.
Well, I was going to say, speaking of confusion stories, what do you make of that story this morning, which I think came as quite a surprise to a lot of people that you would imagine shouldn't be surprised by issues like this? Certainly Paul Reid saying that the HSE were not aware of any of this. This is the story that 18 to 30, that the Minister for Health has asked his officials to assess whether 18 to 30 year olds should be prioritised for vaccine.
Yeah, look, I think in fairness to Minister Donnelly, I think all he's doing there is consistently trying to test and question and look at the various options, because this pandemic is not going to end over the next couple of months. Even when the vaccines are fully rolled out, we're going to be left in this situation for time to come. So I do think we have to assess all the different variables, but this is not under consideration by the government. There's no proposals to bring it to government. The run out of the vaccines as set out is the one that's staying there for the moment. It's very effective by the looks of it. I think people have confidence in how it's happening, and that's what needs to happen.
Is it helpful for it to be splashed with a quote directly from the minister himself in the front of a newspaper so soon after there has been such upset and confusion and out of the last change and revision of the priority list?
Well, definitely. The population have change fatigue out there. There's no question about that. They're very tired. And I think.
So was this ill-advised today to put it out in that way?
Well, I think in the circumstances, it's always important that no matter what the minister is doing, that there is that level of transparency out there that anything he is considering. But it is not a matter that's been considered by the government. The rollout of the vaccines as set out by the government in the last couple of weeks is the one we're proceeding with over the next couple of months, and people are reassured that that is what's going to happen.
OK, let me bring in David Cullinan. David, did you spit out your cornflakes this morning when you saw that story?
I found it very confusing, to be honest, Katie. And, you know, it says that the minister asked his officials to examine this. The head of the HSE was completely unaware of it. And it does show then that there is confusion in relation to what the minister might be looking at, what the head of the HSE is aware of. And all of this, as has been said anyway, has to be underpinned by the medical and the scientific advice. And what we clearly need to see is a plan and certainty in relation to the vaccine rollout. And Roisin and I would, every Thursday, be in a position to ask questions to the Minister for Health in the Dáil. There's a standing slot on asking questions on the vaccine rollout, and it has to be said that the lack of clarity and the lack of a plan from the Minister over the last number of weeks and months has been breathtaking. And I think that we're at a very crucial, in fact, a tipping point in the battle against COVID. And there is an awful lot of room to be optimistic. Okay. I'm very pleased with the optimistic tone that has been struck by NPHET. And clearly what we need to do is to get all of the responses right and have very strong leadership and confident management of the vaccine rollout, of tests and trace and of quarantine. And if we get those right, Katie, over the next few weeks, we're in a really strong position going into the summer, which is why these type of headlines can confuse people, can create uncertainty when we need a very joined up plan from the HSE, the Department of Health, the Minister, NIAC and the expert panel.
OK, to be fair, Roisin Shortall, much of the uncertainty and confusion will completely be out of the control of the government and their officials over the last number of weeks.
Well, I think if you're talking about the supply of vaccines, yes, of course, I think we all accept that that is dependent on the various pharmaceutical companies. But what we do need clarity on, and very good messaging, is exactly what the approach is that's being taken by government. And, you know, we've been told all along that, for example, that priority is given on the basis of age and vulnerability. And then a headline like this morning's just cuts right across that, and people are saying, what on earth is going on?
But is there sense to it, though? Because I did hear Kingston Mills making the case for this some time ago, that once you get the
very, you know, the people we know that are vulnerable, which is the over 50s, basically, vaccinated, then you start looking at controlling the levels of infection in the community generally. And the best way to do that is to vaccinate the people who have most exposure.
So, Katie, there's risk involved in every aspect of this. So it is a matter of assessing the risk, seeking best medical advice, and then balancing that risk. And like what was said this morning in those headlines went against everything that we understood to be the case. And that's confusing for people. And I don't think it's wise for ministers to be thinking aloud or spinning stories or musing as has been going on. We need a very clear plan for how the vaccines are going to be administered over the next 3 months. And, you know, on the basis that the promises on delivery will come through, and this is then how it's going to be done and who is going to administer those vaccines. And I also think it would be very helpful that on the basis of that vaccine programme being rolled out as expected and on the basis of the data going in the right direction, continuing to go in the right direction. And I mean, there's been fantastic success so far, thanks to the efforts being put in by everybody. But if we can continue in that direction, well, then there should be a roadmap set out. We're promised that in a couple of weeks' time. I think for everybody's sake and just to keep spirits up, it would be very helpful if that could be provided sooner rather than later.
It's not helpful for ministers to be thinking aloud, James Brown.
Well, look, I think what people need to focus on is the decision by the government. Any decisions around COVID is a decision by government, and I think there's an awful lot to be hopeful about. 95% of the vaccines have been rolled out within the week of them coming into the country. 20% of the over 16s have now at least gotten their first shot of vaccine. We've seen the bonus with Pfizer, an extra 500,000 coming in, and we are on target to have over 80% of the adult population who want to be vaccinated by the 1st of July, and we can then move towards opening up the country as well. So I think there's an awful lot to be hopeful there. Absolutely. And we have prioritised the older and the vulnerable people, and we've seen the success of that in Ireland. We look at Italy, we look at Chile. Chile has had half their population, the first vaccine, and they're in the midst of another epidemic as well of COVID.
Well, did you mention Chile? It brings me on to the next point, because the issues in Chile, they believe, is that variants, particularly the P1, a Brazilian variant, basically scuppered their vaccination program and has put them into a very bad position now. And of course, our big drive against that is mandatory hotel quarantine. But it's running into all sorts of problems. The European Commission now has given Ireland 10 days to respond to a letter outlining concerns about mandatory hotel quarantine. This follows an angry backlash from EU countries who were added to the red list. The letter asks for clarifications on how countries are picked to be put on the red list, because they reckon 5 countries selected don't represent the highest infection rates. So we asked that question again this week. We were asking it of our studio panel last week. But this is what we got. This is the response we got from the department. That the countries are, the expert advisory group on travel meets every 2 weeks to recommend amendments to the list of designated states. And that takes into account countries with outbreaks involving known variants of concern, countries with very high 14-day incidence, that's over 500 per 100,000, and countries with a high 14-day incidence, that is 2.5 times Ireland's rate of incidence. So they're the 3 criteria. But you look at that then, you think, well, how come Poland isn't on our list? Because they are currently at 840 or thereabouts per 100,000. And we looked back over what was said about this during the week. And here is what the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, told Mary Wilson was the criteria that were being used last Monday morning.
For the EU, it's variants of concern. That's the single biggest priority for me and the single biggest priority for public health. Outside of the EU, the public health team have applied 3 criteria. The first is variants of concern, and then the second and third are about very high incidence rates. The first of those is if a country has a 14-day rate over 500, and the second is if a country has a 14-day incident rate more than 2.5 times Ireland's rate.
Okay, so I'm still a bit confused there. Maybe James Brown, you can clarify for me, because our response from the department gave no indication that there was a different criteria being used for EU countries as opposed to all the other countries on the list. Is that the case, that in terms of EU countries, it's all about the variants, and the incidence rates aren't really taken into account. Whereas for all the other countries, even if you don't have proof that there's variants circulating there, if you have a high incidence, you'll get on the list.
Well, with the expert advisory group takes in a blend of all the different considerations that need to be taken into account. But when you're dealing with the European Union, we do have the freedom of movement as well that needs to be taken into consideration as part of the EU. And while the EU members have agreed that restrictions can be put in place, and I think Ireland is right to put in the mandatory hotel quarantine in place and apply where it needs to be done, that you can't you have to take into account the legalities of it as well, about the impact of those restrictions on the EU and the freedom of movement of everybody within the European Union. So you have to take all of those things into balance and into consideration in terms of making their recommendations.
Okay, but is that the case though? Is it exactly a set out that when it comes to, look, the only criteria applied for the European countries, EU countries, is whether, if they have variants, if they have variants of concern that we need to worry about?
Well, I don't have the specifics on that, and I can certainly get them. But as I understand it, there can be a slightly different approach taken to the European Union members as the non-European Union members.
No, Roisin is shaking her head there.
I don't actually think that's right, Minister. I was very surprised when I heard Minister Donnelly say that on Monday morning, that there was a different approach being taken to EU countries. And for that reason, I raised this with Ronan Glynn on Tuesday at the Health Committee and queried it. And Ronan Glynn was very clear that their advice is that those three criteria that you listed there, Katie, would apply to all countries, and there should be no distinction made between European countries and the rest of the world. And I mean, there's a further point on that.
Do we then explain why, for instance, I keep coming back to Poland, because they just have a very, very high incidence rate at the moment?
Well, again, I would say that all of these decisions should be based on the science, and they shouldn't have political considerations. But, you know, an important point about this, a big part of the reason why we're concerned to protect the country against the importation of the virus, but particularly in relation to the variants of concern, that's why we're putting all these protections in place. But, you know, there are many European countries that don't do genomic sequencing.
So we're shooting in the dark, really.
We're shooting in the dark. We've no idea about the level of variants of concern in many European countries. So it just makes no sense whatsoever to use one criteria.
David Cullinan.
Katie, if you look at the ECDC map, it clearly shows the prevalence of the disease in countries across Europe. And if you were to look at the map and then compare that to countries which are on the quarantine list, countries like Poland, Hungary and Estonia, you could argue, could be added as well. But I think the wider point here is the one that was made by Colm Henry earlier, that we obviously have to be concerned about the P1 and the 351 variant. We have to slow down the entry. We have to make sure that mandatory quarantine is in place to allow us to do all of that. And we also have to make clear, we have to ensure that there is clarity in relation to the criteria that governs when countries are added to the list. Because for me, this isn't about politics. It isn't about government versus opposition. It's about public health. It's about getting this right. And as we enter into this very crucial phase, and I have to say, we have to be optimistic about where we could be in a few weeks' time, but we also have to listen to the public health experts who say that if we take any risks, if we're not careful, if we don't have strong leadership and competent management in relation to all of these responses, and we move too soon, or we don't do enough on quarantine, then we run the risk of undoing all of the good work. And I don't want to see mandatory quarantine in place for any longer than it's necessary. It needs to be in place for a short, sharp period of time based on public health advice. Okay. And if we get it right with the vaccine rollout, we'll put ourselves in a strong position, which we all want to be in. If we get it wrong, and there's mismanagement, then we run the risk of longer lockdowns, and nobody wants to see that.
Okay. The other thing we've seen with mandatory hotel quarantine in the last couple of weeks is a huge amount of traffic down to the High Court. Up until now, it seems we the state hasn't put up a defence to the cases for the pleas for exemptions that were put forward, and everybody was. The case basically where people were allowed out of quarantine before those cases were adjudicated. Now, I understand today is actually the first case that there's a South African woman who has taken a case to the High Court who has had COVID herself, has had an AstraZeneca vaccination. And that case, as I understand it, is likely to be adjudicated by the High Court today. Do we need more exemptions to deal with this, James Brown? Is that where we're going with this ultimately? because clearly we can't continue a situation where there's a constant stream of people heading to the High Court.
But I think you have to remember what mandatory hotel quarantine is. We're detaining people who are coming into the country. Now, that's done in very, very limited circumstances in this country, either within our justice system, within our criminal system, or involuntary detention for somebody who's suffering from a mental illness. So it's a very serious step, and we have a constitutional protections for people in terms of detention. So it was always going to be tested within the courts. It was fully expected
that
it
would
be. But
should there not have been a more robust appeals process built into it? So that would have mitigated some of those issues.
Well, there is a strong appeals process in place, and I think there's been about 400 appeals, and about 7% of those have been accepted. But like, as in, for example, our district court system, you know, people will always appeal up to the higher courts. People have that entitlement too, and that's an important part and protections within our constitutional system here in Ireland. So I think it's not to be unexpected, but especially in situations where you're detaining people other than outside of the justice system or for mental illness, I was always expecting and always going to happen.
Roisin.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important just to bear in mind the whole purpose of a hotel quarantining is to discourage travel. And it's very interesting, I think, to look at the report that Jack Horgan-Jones has in today's Irish Times, which shows that last month, as recently as last month, the vast majority of people coming into this country were coming back or going out on holidays. Now, I mean, obviously the message isn't getting across or the enforcement of that isn't adequate. So I mean, we need to address that issue. But I mean, the whole point about, as you say, the whole question of hotel quarantining, I think there is a problem there with the appeal system. There are obviously humanitarian grounds on which people should get exemptions.
And should we expand those? Because, you know, the ones that would everyone would feel sympathy for, which is you're coming home, you have a relative who is very ill, or you're coming home for a funeral, or, you know, those.
Yeah, there are standards. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. But a point about the exemption system is that people are required to come here first before they apply for an exemption. So they have to come here, book into a hotel, pay for the hotel, and then seek an exemption. And that just doesn't make sense at all. It's not efficient by any means, and it's not fair to people either. And that's why it should be possible to apply for an exemption before you leave the country.
Well, I think
that
it makes sense
from.
If the purpose of it, which it is to discourage people from coming here in the first place, then I think it does make sense, because if you open up applications for exemptions for across the world before you get there, I think you could be very quickly swamped with applications from people looking for an exemption, and it will encourage even more people to come here. But as you say,
but there are genuine cases, you know,
absolutely.
And they should be dealt with.
The problem here, Katie,
The
problem here, Katie, is that the government spent 10 months or more pushing back against any of these checks on travel. And at the very start of this, they pushed back against testing at airports. They pushed back against mandatory PCR testing pre-arrival. They came late in all of these issues. And then very late in the day, they embraced hotel mandatory quarantine. And then when they came late, they rushed into all of this, and there wasn't sufficient consultation. And they were seeing and paying the price for all of that. And what we're talking here about people who are travelling for non-essential purposes. And yes, it is very tough, but it's small numbers of people. But we have to weigh that against the risk of new variants coming in. And we know that 19 cases are already being reported from people who tested positive. Four of those were from variants of concern. And that's the risk. If we don't have these measures in place, and we're talking about people travelling for non-essential purposes, everybody will be losing out. There's a huge risk. Okay. And what we don't want to do is undo all of the good work, the heavy lifting that has been done by the public who've abided by very tough restrictions. And I'll go back to the point I made. This shouldn't be about politics.
Okay.
It has to be about public health.
Okay,
listen to what the experts are saying. Stay the course for the next few weeks and put us in a strong position as we come into the early summer months.
It's very disappointing, and it's galling for people who have been restricted to 5 kilometres for, you know, almost for 4 months now, and everybody putting in such a big effort. And when we hear then that the government hasn't taken steps to address the issue of people going off on holidays or coming back in here, you know, in February, the government announced that they were going to increase the fines for people who are taking unnecessary journeys and travelling for non-essential reasons. But that has only come in the last few days. You know, so there's delays in all of these things, and all of this stuff should have been dealt with last year. And we'd be in a very different place if it had been.
Can I ask before we leave this, exit strategy? How long, what are we looking at? Because I know Micheál Martin saying, the Taoiseach saying this week, that he regards it as a short-term policy. What is the thinking in terms of now that we are in this and trying to somehow manoeuvre a way through it, what are we looking at? Could we still be having these restrictions in place this time next year or at the end of this year?
In terms of mandatory hotel quarantining,
yes.
No, I don't think that's sustainable at all. And I think that's one of the reasons that the idea that you could have had mandatory hotel quarantining, for example, for the last year, I don't think that would have been sustainable. I think it can only be for the short term.
What does short term mean?
My personal view is that probably only a couple of months, I think by July, if we can. But it will all depend on the number of variants and the COVID rates in other countries. And as you see those numbers going down in other countries, those countries can come back off the list. And that's what you're hoping to do in terms of leaving it. But it needs to stay there in the background as a necessary weapon against COVID variants as and when needed.
OK, we leave that one there because I want to move on. We'll take a break, but after that, we'll be talking about small businesses and the plans to reopen in the coming weeks.
Tweet at Saturday RTE.
Now, as you heard there in the bulletin at 1 o'clock, there is increasing confidence in government that restrictions on intercounty travel could be lifted at some point in June. And in just over a week, the government is expected to set out a plan for the further reopening of society and the economy throughout May, June and July. I want to bring in Neil MacDonald, CEO of ISMI. And now, ISMI, of course, representing over 10,000 small and medium businesses nationwide. Good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Yeah, Neil, a lot of your members will be very heartened by that confirmation today and that increasing confidence about reopening. But there are challenges.
Of course there are. And while our members are increasingly confident about the economy and the direction of travel over the summer with the rollout of the vaccination campaign, I think a great number of businesses were disappointed that a more rapid reopening was not attempted. Week commencing the 12th of April, we had hoped that click and collect and certain other aspects of construction, hospitality and grooming might be reopened, if only on an appointment basis or click and collect for certain retailers.
You're getting calls, Neil, from some of your members preparing to reopen when they get the green light. This is people like hoteliers, people in cleaning services. But they're saying they're having an issue about employees who are currently on the PUP turning down the part-time hours that they are now being offered.
Yes, unfortunately, the way in which the PUP payment is constructed at the moment for employees is that there's no flexibility around income in it. So any worker who has anything other than zero income to declare cannot claim the PUP. And so when there are hotels and cleaning businesses that are doing preemptive work now for an expected reopening or partial reopening, at least in May and June, but they are struggling to get people to come back to work unless they can commit to full-time hours for them, which a great many of them can't do. So I think we're going to need to look at some of the flexibilities that, for example, exist for the self-employed. They're allowed to earn up to €960 over 2 months without threatening the PUP payment. But we're going to have to think a little bit more laterally about how we get people progressively back to work while a lot of the sectors in the economy are not yet open.
Well, just to be clear, employees, as it stands, you can claim part-time job seekers benefits or short-time work support payments if you are unemployed for some days of the week. That presumably people who would come off the PUP payment could also claim that. But is it that it's not worth their while to do that?
Exactly. It is the quandary of how much do I get versus a known €350. You're right to say that you can claim back. But the problem is when you make these very simple in straight up entitlements to say €350, and then someone has to take a longer customer journey to get to avail of a payment somewhere else, people will tend to take the shortest and simplest route to income.
But of course, PUP recipients are supposed to be genuinely seeking work, and therefore if they are offered jobs, even if it is part-time work, are they required to accept that, those job offers?
Well, they should be, Katie. That is part of the, they are part of the terms for qualification for the PUP, but it's not something that employers are in a position to either police or enforce. If someone doesn't come back, then they don't come back.
Yeah, I'll just put that to the panel here. James Brown, that's a could be a really serious problem, because not just for this period where people are preparing to open, but presumably many hospitality businesses won't be able to open up fully anyway without indoor trade. So they might be only able to offer part-time hours.
They might be, but I think the risk around people turning down work would be quite small. We had this last summer as well, when over 400,000 people came back off the PUP payments. We have to remember about people on the PUP payments. There were people who were working before COVID hit. There are people who want to work. And in terms of the hospitality industry, probably a bigger challenge for a lot of them when, as they fully reopen up, is actually maybe have lost some of their key workers who have gone off to maybe find alternative work. So, and my office dealt with numerous cases of this last summer. When you pointed out to people that there are other part-time supports there, if they go back to work, and if the COVID hits back again and the premises goes back down, you can go back on PUP payment. The vast majority of people go back to work. Well, they want to work, and the numbers in this kind of real time is very quite small.
Is that the sense you're getting, Neil, that the numbers are going to be quite
small? Yeah, we don't doubt that the numbers are small, and the issue is, you know, your panel are correct, this is confined to certain sectors, and the greater difficulty in those, for example, in hospitality that has been shut so long, is that people have taken full-time employment in areas like retail, distribution and so on, because there is full-time employment there. So it may be that it is the case that many hospitality businesses, when they reopen their doors, their staff will not be there to take them back in.
Well, we did ask the Department of Social Protection about this, and they told us that they've established an employer reporting facility to enable employers to notify the department of staff not willing to return to work while they continue to claim PUP payments. They said in a statement to the programme, they've received notification of 2,900 cases, all of which have been investigated. The vast majority did not involve misclaiming. And they say, we would nevertheless encourage employers to continue to submit details to us where they come across reluctance of staff to return to work. The department can also help with identifying replacement staff. What do you make of that, Roisin?
I don't like the tone of that reply, I must say. I think Neil has identified a very valid issue here. And it's not as if there's going to be all of these full-time jobs available. And obviously, people want to get back into full-time work. But there is a particular issue here associated with the gradual reopening of hospitality in particular. And I think there's a need for a special measure there. And
what kind of special measure?
This kind of approach isn't new to the Department of Social Protection. They call it is tapering. So one payment reduces down as another pay as wages go up. And, you know, that's used in relation to lone parent payments. It's used in relation to back to work allowance. So it should be possible for the department to come up with a scheme to address that. We wouldn't expect people to go off a payment and be worse off by working.
Yeah.
But it's possible to balance that. And that has been done in other schemes. These are exceptional circumstances.
David Cullinan, would you agree there that the payment should be, this PUP payment should be extended beyond its current expiry date, which is of course June 30th, you know, given how much uncertainty now is around this?
I do, absolutely, and I just want to echo the point that was made. The vast majority of workers will want to go back to work and will go back to work. And I think in terms of the tapering of supports, that's exactly what needs to happen, because we have to understand that in certain sectors, businesses will open gradually. There won't be a big bang when it's back to normal, and it can't be the case that there's a cliff edge where all of the supports for businesses or indeed for workers just goes with a business reopening, because we have to look at the nature of the business, how it will reopen. But I would make make the point as well that there are lots of low paid jobs in the hospitality sector. I think as we work our way through this pandemic, the issue of a living wage has come to the fore. Again, I welcome belatedly a commitment from the Taoiseach that he will look at this. So I think there are areas that we also have to look at. But in the very short term, I think, yes, tapering of supports both for businesses and workers will have to be looked at as we face into what will be a gradual reopening for many businesses. And I think it's good that we are in this optimistic position that we can finally see some hope for those businesses who have been closed, some of them since last March, you know, of last year. It's been horrendous for many businesses.
Indeed. Neil, can I ask you about that other big story of this week that broke yesterday, that KBC may be exiting the Irish market after an approach by Bank of Ireland? How worried are your members about what's happening now in the banking market?
The membership of among the ISMI members, those who would be associated with or banking with KBC, would actually be very small. It's less than 1%. They'd more or less be 80% between Bank of Ireland and AIB, and 11-13% Ulster Bank. The bigger issue here is that we are moving from what is an effective duopoly to an actual duopoly. With the departure of Ulster and KBC, we will have no meaningful competition in banking services. This means that business and retail customers have no banking power. They have no power to realistically to move their account elsewhere. There is only a choice of two. And I think there needs to be some very serious reflection now by the Department of Finance and the Central Bank as to why we cannot maintain banking entities in this country when similar sized countries like Denmark or New Zealand have far greater banking density.
Okay. Roisin Shorten.
Yeah, there's certainly very big problems in banking in this country, and the situation at the moment is very bad for customers, and it's very bad for small businesses as well because of the lack of competition and lack of choice and lack of access, and that's having very negative implications. And banking, of course, including mortgages in particular, are much more expensive in this country than they are elsewhere. That shouldn't be the case, and it's extraordinary that the Minister for Finance didn't know anything about this until the night before. Look, we need a forum on banking because there are serious problems there, and we need to chart a way out of this so that we take steps, including, you know, Central Bank changing the rules to encourage competition and to encourage other players here. Yeah. But it is something that needs to be dealt with urgently.
James Brown, we just have a minute.
Yeah, look, this obviously is a significant development. It's very regrettable, and especially for the staff and the families that work in KBC, almost 1,400 staff there. I think it's important to remind customers that wherever their accounts move to, that they will be given plenty of notice, and the same protections that are there now will be kept there. We do have two banks and a third bank that is growing stronger, so there is a level of competition there, but mergers are happening right across the world. Banks are exiting right across the world. And most people
we have a particular issue here, though.
We do have a particular issue here. I mean, there's very little barriers to any bank coming into Ireland or setting up in Ireland or provide mortgages. The view seems to be taken that it's simply not profitable because of the size of the market, because of capitalization requirements and a strong regulatory regime that is there that should be kept there. It's important to have it there, but certainly I think it puts off some bankings coming
but
in here.
Just Roisin Shorten's point there, it was incredible that the Minister for Finance only found out about that the night before.
But the KBC is a private company. They're not under
Bank of Ireland. Yeah. Is not entirely a private company.
Well, the government, the Minister of Finance has shares in it, obviously, as the minister.
He's one of the biggest shareholders in it, and he didn't know what was going on.
He does, but the regular regime are there for when directors are meant to inform their shareholders, and that's what happens. But I think it was unfortunate, and I think the minister
could have... But we have been promised a forum, you know, and we've also been promised a third banking force.
I would like to see that forum set up, but I don't think the minister could be involved in it. But
I'm going to have to leave it there. Apologies for cutting across you. Many thanks to my panel and all my guests today. Many thanks to all of you for listening. Today's programme was produced by Mary O'Hagan. Research was by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon, and Gar Duffy was on sound. From all of us here, enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Saturday with Katie Hannan. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.